think since it's 6:17, according to the clock I'm looking at back here, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I'm delighted to see so many of you here. This topic of American women regionalists, which I hope to tell you something about that maybe you don't know and maybe you do know, and in that case I'm even more delighted because it's kind of a marginalized group of writers, and I love them, and have not had an opportunity to really teach them except occasionally in sort of a survey class to bring one or two little excerpts in or something, and so I'm excited to have a week to kind of deal with them a little bit. My name is Beth Boyens. I live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I teach part-time in the English department at Augustana College there, and I'm currently working on my PhD at the University of South Dakota, and my area is 19th century American women writers, and this is sort of a subset of that area as well. So I'd love to have you go around and just really briefly introduce yourself, and then to kind of get us thinking about what I want us to think about this evening, talk a little briefly, since there are so many and we want to have time to get to the material, but to say, when you are traveling, what are your expectations of a guide? When you have somebody guiding you through your travels, what do you hope from them, or what do you expect from that person? So just briefly, your name and that. And maybe we can start back there with you.
I'm Donna Rasmussen, and I guess I would have to say, from a guide, I would hope that they would give me the history around what I'm seeing.
Okay, history.
Hi, my name is Nan Peters. I guess from a guide, I probably would expect to have some knowledge of, knowledge of the area we're looking at.
Okay.
And expertise. Either.
Okay.
My name is Diane Johnston, and I think I would look for somebody who was kind of wanted to introduce me to the culture of the area.
Just now, at my age, starting to travel more. So,
yeah.
I think some of the best trips I ever had is when we got lost.
Yeah.
I'm her guide.
Good. Good. Can you say a little bit more about that idea of getting lost, and what is it about that
seems
is appealing?
To me, an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And you see things that you're not actually looking for.
Uh huh.
But you talk to people as you go along. I do.
Yeah, so maybe even from a guide to sort of lead you into sort of areas of discovery or something.
Yes.
Something that is not sort of the thing that you're checking off the list as, I have to see the Eiffel Tower and I have to go to the Louvre,
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is. Okay, so some kind of discovery maybe. Okay, great.
My name is Susan Byland, and I just want my guide to get me to where I'm supposed to go.
Okay.
So get me there.
Get me to where I'm going. All right, good.
My name is Sharon Kathy, and I think I like Elma's idea of, things that aren't like the Eiffel Tower, something else, different and unknown things that other people don't get just when you go on these tour bus things.
Yeah. I like your phrase of something else. Okay. Good.
I like a guide. I'm Karen Bornfeld. I like a guide that pays attention to people's needs. And sometimes, like when you were in school, the teacher spent more time with the kids that were already knowledgeable about what they were doing.
Okay, so you're looking for a teacher who is attentive to what kind of information you need. Okay, good. Okay.
Barbara Rabbits, and I guess I'm looking for a guide. I'm looking for someone that will tell me things that I don't already know, mm-hmm. and will not be broke. brief, have a brief background in a country or whatever.
Good.
I'm Sandy Nicola, and I do teach literature, and so I'm looking for that part, because I remember being on a tour in England, in the Lake District, and the guide never told us we're special, I mean, the Lake District.
Yeah.
And if I hadn't read enough of my own, I still missed things, because he never said, well, right around the corner is where that is.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted him to tell me more than just, here you are, here's the souvenir shop.
Yeah. Here's where you can get your snow globe.
Yeah. And I learned a lot about what was in the village that we might be in by looking at postcards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good.
Judy Hastek. I think something new and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
I think a guide who is just very connected and passionate about what they're showing us, excited about it. Not, as you said, not a rote, docent kind of a thing where you go, and now we're at blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Dorothy Satry, and I like stories about the area or the people.
Mm-hmm. So a storyteller. Considered that question to open this to, do you prefer traveling with or without a guide? But because we have writers and narrators who are guides, you know, we have a guide whether we sort of want one or not, but we'll be thinking about how they guide. But yeah, I agree. But the unexpected is more likely, and getting lost is more likely to happen without one, right? Yeah. Yes.
I'm Joanne Moldenhauer, and the guides I've enjoyed the most have been the ones who told us things about their experience in the country.
Personal experience. What you would expect from a travel guide when you are traveling, what do you hope to?
Yeah, we buy more often without a travel guide, so I...
And why is that?
Because we like to discover things on our own, and also because, but sometimes if you meet someone in a foreign country that takes you into their home or shares things with you, that's very special, because then you get an idea really of what more the, you know, the local people are, how they're living. That's really valuable.
Yeah.
I'm Janet Lightlover, and I was connecting with the idea of a storyteller and the insider's view and the local people, because what I want is for a guide to help me get closer to the people who live there so I can learn more about how people in that area or that culture live their life. Makes it easier, I think, to have conversation. Create relationships.
Olson, and I like guides that really get into it and love it and give you personal stories of things that have happened. And we had one guide once, just going down to Portland, and he said, Battleground, where's the battleground? So he takes out a little thing and he goes, oh, he reads to us about
Battleground.
I mean, this is fun.
Yeah, right. So that passion
for storytelling. I'm Roxy Giddings, and I want my guide, and I've been in 20 countries, I think, and the guides, the best guides are the ones that smooth my way. In other words, they don't take me someplace that's too dangerous for people to be, and they like you say, they don't read the stuff. I mean, I can read,
yeah.
But if I don't know the language, they smooth my way.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't know exactly where the cathedral is, or maybe I want to go to an English service on Sunday morning and I don't know where it is, they do.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
they smooth my way.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's an interesting image, isn't it? Yeah.
Peques, and I like stories more than details, and
mm-hmm.
people who have sort of an intuitive way of making sense of it. Their culture.
Marcia Boss.
Mm-hmm.
I like fresh, lively, authentic storytellers with a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. Well, good idea.
Sense of humor.
Perfect. Sense of humor, yes.
Isn't it interesting
that's
how we
good.
Remember
yeah.
something better when we
sure
laughed
one.
About it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you.
I'm Paul Roby. And with some of the other folks, I was grateful they said they'd prefer to go alone. I don't want a guide to get in my way.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's right.
And I was afraid that was going to be a token male response. Tell a couple other people.
Yeah.
So that there's some room to still explore and be directly involved.
Yeah, and to sort of interpret for yourself, right?
Exactly.
I mean, the problem with a guide is that they often tell you what to think, right?
I don't want it to be a movie.
Yeah. Say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, but you don't want to go home and read about what you missed.
It's you know, it's prescribed and canon,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It, you know, it goes the same every time it's shown.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. That's good.
Mm-hmm. So, so we're going to meet some guides tonight, who are attempting to take the reader into a particular region, their region of the United States. Tonight, the region that just sort of by sheer happenstance, all these writers are from the New England area, which maybe shouldn't come as a big surprise, granted that they were writing during the mid-19th century into the late 19th century. Some have said that really the only true American authors came out of New England. you know, you think of Hawthorne and Melville and all those guys who were writing at that time, that's where it was happening. I would argue that that is not true. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that's who I've chosen for tonight. So when you hear the term regionalism, what comes to mind? Is that a new term for you? Is that something you've thought about before? What does that mean to you, regionalism? Yeah.
Well, I usually think of Southern often.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's that
it's
is a strong,
modern,
yeah, and the sort of gothic
right.
kind of writing that comes out of that area. Yeah. Other things.
Geography.
Yeah.
That it's writers who are tied to a place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which it is. That's one way of describing it, certainly.
The culture of an area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where the setting is almost a character.
Yes. And in fact, Mary Austin, who... about whom I'm going to talk on Thursday afternoon, that's what she says too, that regionalism the place has to be a character more than just a backdrop for the story. Yeah, that's how she describes it. Other thoughts about regionalism?
And stereotypes?
Yeah.
I guess that's sort of what you were saying.
Yeah. And that I think that notion comes out of, although we can talk about it as we go here too, but I think that notion of stereotype comes out of local color
mm-hmm.
fiction, which is also being written at the exact same time as regionalism. And some scholars will even use those two terms interchangeably, right? In local color, we think of Mark Twain, we think of Bret Hart, Hamlin Garland, those guys who are writing... George Washington Cable, you know, who used this real heavy dialect in their writing that you can hardly even decipher when you're reading because it's so thick and it's difficult to understand the characters. But one of the things I want to talk about is that those local color writers, so that's a great segue, were writing from a distance, that they were showing us a region or an area, but as a distance observer. They were coming out of the realist genre, right, where they, this notion of, well, I have to be more like a journalist. Now, Janet will argue with me about what that means to be a journalist, right, that we shouldn't be so tied to having to be objective to be a journalist. But those guys were writing that way, that they wanted to be more like reporters and tell a story from an objective point of view. So local color comes out of a tradition where they're trying to show us a people but still remain detached. Regionalism, which tends to be considered more of female writers who were writing at that time, comes out of a very different situatedness in terms of the narrator. That instead of staying on the outside, that you as the reader are drawn into, you know, the local taverns where and homes, and not really taverns because it would be improper for a woman to write about a tavern in the 19th century, but into homes and into communities in order to get to know the locals, which is what you guys are saying. That's one of the things you love, right, about a guide. So that's what they were sort of aiming to do, was to show a region more from an insider's point of view. An interesting thing to note about the time in which local color and regionalism were most prevalent is that it's right after the Civil War. All right, so we've had this great war on our own soil that is fought largely because of regionalism, right?
Yeah.
North and South being divided because this culture is different from this culture, and this way of life is different from this way of life, and our ideology is different from the other ideology. And so it comes at an interesting time where this strong notion of region has torn our country asunder, right? And then this literature sort of swoops in and says, and tries to, in some ways, heal those wounds from the Civil War with regionalism by saying, look at how this area is, and isn't this sort of a beautiful thing that these people have this culture and this... Yeah, and so it's an interesting way to try to heal a wound with sort of the same ideas of what caused the wound in the first place. So there's that going on. I mean, there's also a lot going on in the women's movement at that time, right? And so feminism is sort of coming into fruition, and regionalism was a way for women writers to give voice to women characters whom up to that point really had no voice. These are largely small communities, agricultural communities, right? These are farmers' wives who are completely silenced, right, in any literature by Hawthorne or Melville or any of those guys. And if they come up at all, they're either shrews or they're, you know, I mean, they're not very lovable characters or even very fully drawn characters. So that's part of the impetus for these women writing at this time, too. Oh, time is just running away. All right, so let's get to some of the writing. And I don't have enough copies, so we'll have to share, and I apologize for that.
Oh, wait, it's
two-sided and 10. Stowe, and she may arguably be the most famous regionalist author, right? You all know Harriet Beecher Stowe. What is she most famous for? Uncle Tom's Cabin, which comes out of the sentimental tradition of literature, right? I mean, what was the purpose of Uncle Tom's Cabin?
To gain sympathy for the
Right.
Abolitionist.
1851, it comes out. It's this huge abolitionist novel, and let's do away with slavery. It's very didydactic, heavy, heavy, right, sermonizing in this novel. Strong Christian characters and all of that sort of thing. Very sentimental. And that, Nathaniel Hawthorne is sort of infamous for saying that Stowe and other women writing around the same time, he called them a mob of scribbling women. Right?
Oh.
We're being overrun by this mob of scribbling women. Well, what you might not know is that at the time, these women were publishing the pants off of Hawthorne.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
And readers were just eating them up and paying very little attention to what Hawthorne was saying. So he was quite threatened by this mob of scribbling women, right? But what's interesting about Stowe, I think, in terms of her regionalism, is that she is doing something quite different with regionalism from what she did with Uncle Tom's Cabin. Go ahead and read just that little excerpt, which is the preface to a collection of sketches that she called Old Town Folks.
Mm-hmm.
And this is her preface. So just take a look at that and think about the impressions that you're getting from that little reading. So what are you noticing about her preface? Maybe I'm interrupting you before you're finished. No.
She signs her name Horace. Is that right? So she takes on that male persona?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, so what do you think of that?
Well, she knows the world.
She does. I mean, right? Yes. I mean, and she is really, I mean, some scholars have said that it's suggestive that she is really not fully ready yet to give complete voice to a female narrator. That she's just not ready yet to do that.
So this is after Uncle Tom's Cabin?
It is. And interestingly enough, Uncle Tom's Cabin has a fairly strong female narrative voice, really. But again, that's coming out of a sentimental tradition, which was women writing for women primarily, and they were sort of taking on a maternal role, right? That I can teach you, fellow woman, sister, or daughter of mine, I can teach you something as a mother figure. That's kind of the primary narrative mode for sentimental fiction, and they can kind of get away with it that way. But this is something different. Now she's moving into a different mode of writing in which that has largely been inhabited by male writers, and she is trying to show you a particular place. And it isn't especially didactic, right? It isn't meant necessarily what she does with old town folks isn't to teach you something exactly, although I would argue that most literature is intended to teach you something, right? But it doesn't have the same sort of sermonizing ideal. So, but she's not quite ready to say, but it's okay for a woman to step into that role. And so she sort of hides behind this male narrator, which is partly the title of where
she did take ownership of Uncle Tom's Cabin as a woman, and it was read by women and men, right?
Yes.
But then after that, she decided...
Because she's shifting into a slightly
different
genre,
yeah.
and with a different kind of goal in mind, objective for the work. Yeah. Other things you noticed about her preface?
Well, it seemed the way that she's writing the preface that... It has a little bit of local color to it because it says, I'm standing back, I'm reflecting this to you, I want you to make up your own mind, I'm not preaching. And so it has more of an objective look than how I thought you described regionalism.
Yeah, yeah, and she does do that. And partly I think that's the male narrator. Partly she's fairly early for this regional thing coming up, but she is presenting herself as an objective observer, which was the way that authors were expected to be presenting themselves at that time. So she's definitely taking that stance, yeah.
It seems that the first paragraph is inconsistent with the later paragraph. She says about having an object in the book, and then she
professors that I propose neither to teach nor preach.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, well, what's your object? And, you know, I mean, she does say that it's just a sympathetic spectator to kind of show who these people are, let them speak through their own voices.
Right.
But then what is the object of letting these people speak through their own voices? So,
right, right. She's working really hard to step out of that teaching mode. I don't want to interpret this for you, right? And yet, I feel that I need to tell you that I have an object for writing this, right? A justification for doing it, which is not unusual for a woman writer at that time either, to feel the need to justify writing, right?
The second sentence is almost an apology.
Mm-hmm.
Asking for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Which is also typical for prefaces written by women at this time. I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself. I just had to write this book. Please forgive me. Here it
no,
is.
I'm not supposed to be doing this.
Exactly. 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 Anything else you notice? I mean, I find that this second section that I have there, in doing this work, I've tried to make my mind as still and passive as a looking glass or a mountain lake, and then to give you merely the images reflected there.
Mm.
That's a very romantic notion of the author. That's almost Wordsworthian, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you just still your own mind and then let things come to you and then you reflect them back. So she's got all kinds of interesting things going on here between realism and romanticism and sentimentalism and all these kind of different genres coming together in this one little preface. Anything else? I want to make sure we get to the other two as well. Well, Alice Carey is the second author I have on the sheet here for you, and she may be an author that you are not as familiar with. She, Carey lived around Cincinnati just as Stowe did, and grew up mostly surrounded by women, sisters, and lots of sisters, and she lived with her sisters till she died, so had a very, very feminine community around her all the time. She seems to be able to, although she's writing earlier than Stowe, she seems to be more willing, I think you'll see, maybe, to take a leap into letting a female narrator speak for herself. This preface comes from a book, again, a series of sketches. If a regionalist work was longer, it tended not to be a novel exactly. It tended to be a series of sketches that could be read like a novel, but could also be read individually. And hers is called Clovernook, and those sketches take place in a fictionalized town that is a lot like Mount Healthy, which is the area that she grew up in. So go ahead and take a look at her preface, and it does go over to the other side as well. Observations about Carey's preface.
Thou protestest too much.
Say more about that. What do you mean?
She just said, and on and on and on and on. And I mean, it's
hard to read.
Like, the whole thing is like an apology, and I don't really know what you want to read, and I don't really know what I want to write, but we've got to have something going here.
So if she is your travel guide, how are you feeling in her hands?
It's like an apology for the area not being very interesting. So there's not much of interest here, but since you're here anyway, I'll show up to you.
Do you think she's saying that, or is she saying that other people have suggested that there isn't much of interest there? And that
she could make you feel, if you were interested in this class, that you were special.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just for a few people that have the special calling to look at the farming people or the rural people. If you're one of those, then you would feel like you're a part of the in-club. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Even though it's too wordy.
Okay.
There are two things that strike me. One, when she says, in the far west where pioneers are still busy with felling the opposing trees, here we have an early environmentalist. That's a very strong statement. So there's real strength in that, I thought. And then on the next page, however much there may be of pity, there is surely little of sympathy. And that notion of pity strikes me because she's instantly saying that the people over here feel they are different from the people over here. They pity them. What they are, these people could never be. They're different from and better from.
Yes.
Therefore.
And so, in some ways, I think she's, with that, also setting up the difference between what she is doing and what Bret Hart is doing, for example. He's pitying the locals that he's writing about in his local color sketches, and she is trying to show us a more sympathetic, or I would argue empathetic, view of the people that she's going to show us, the homes that she's going to invite us into.
I mean, she's saying my work is as important as all the old
Yeah, she is situating herself pretty clearly, I think, as an important writer, even though she's apologizing for it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and this, I think, is indicative of sort of the dance that women writers were having to do at that time.
Yeah.
Both established themselves as viable authors and sort of remember or have to be constantly reminded that they are nonetheless still women, right? And authorship is huge at this time. This is the birth of the professional author in America. And really, Alice Carey is in a lot of ways responding to, there was a tremendous call at this time for an American literature, right? Up to this time, Americans have been reading mostly British literature that has come over on the boat. And copyright laws didn't exist, and so even British literature was just passed off as, I mean, nobody knew who wrote anything, really. And now copyright laws are in place, and professionalization of the author is happening, so, and they're becoming sort of celebrities. Melville was like a sex object, right? And he was like, I don't know, like the, you know, Tom Cruise of why I shouldn't use him, he's kind of falling. of the day, right? And so she's situating herself as an author who is viable to be read, I think, in this preface. Yeah.
I think that she's emphasizing the fact that she is lifting up what we would see as insignificance, and she is going to get into it and show us there is something here that is really beautiful, and that deserves our attention, and also that it is very honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can almost like saying, test this out, because what I'm going to tell you is true and it's real.
And you would like that in a guide, right?
Yes.
In a travel guide.
Yeah.
Isn't it a plea to just open your mind and be ready for anything? And she kind of hitting on the things that she thinks you might have your mind closed to, and telling you which ones she has her mind open to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. But in some ways, she's trying to do that. And then I'm thinking of, you know, what you said, Paul. Then she's indicating, I think, in some ways, that she's going to get out of your way.
Yeah.
And in the service of that, I was going to say I really like the artistry that.
Mm-hmm.
I love the phrase after the wind, you quoted Janet about the trees, not yet time for the reeds music.
Mm-hmm.
And she hears her life as music.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're still cutting down trees, you can't. And then she describes it as shadows and sunbeams.
Yeah.
I thought it was very evocative.
Yes. And Hawthorne describes writing in similar ways. He, in his preface to The Scarlet Letter, he talks about being in the custom house where he was working at the time and being sort of moved by the shadows that played on the walls at night in there, and that is what it sort of evoked the muse in him to write The Scarlet Letter. And she's playing with that a little bit, I think, here. That whole romantic, again, like Stowe with the stilling your mind like a looking glass, that whole romantic notion of the artist. Yeah. Yeah.
So does she accomplish her goal, do you think, in the end?
I think she does. I mean, her sketches are really quite beautiful and interesting, and she has interesting female characters that and she seems to think of them as kind of a knitting group, right? And her sketches become sort of this knitting together of stories that...
Did she achieve some fame in her time?
Yeah. Yeah, all these women achieved a fair amount of fame in their time. I mean, they were published largely in periodicals, you know, good housekeeping type, you know, journals that came out, and they were published serially, and women looked forward to their next piece, and yeah. If you want to go ahead and take a look at the last one, Sarah Orne Jewett is probably the most celebrated regionalist now, and even at the time she was very popular, and her most popular novel or series of sketches, again, it's hard to differentiate, Country of the Pointed Firs, takes place in Maine, and this is her first chapter or first sketch in that piece, which I think acts as a preface. So go ahead and take a look at that. Jewett is writing a little later still, right? It's almost the 20th century when she is writing, and she has the advantage of all these other writers who have come before her and have described New England to the reading public. And so Jewett doesn't have to work quite so hard to convince us that it's worth a worthwhile area to read about. And B, she doesn't have to work quite so hard to describe it either. She can kind of just say a New England coastal town, and her readers will have images evoked already, because that work has kind of been done by her predecessors. So, but what are your observations of Jewett?
She fell in love with this character of the city. She's in love with it.
Yeah. So now the region is definitely a character. Yeah.
She doesn't use the first person.
No. Do you notice a shift in what we've read with Stowe and Carey into Jewett, or even within Jewett herself here? I noticed
she makes inanimate things become like a living being. Yeah, it's like, and she says that actually, but she says it, you're feeling it.
Okay.
That the house is alive. I mean, even just sitting there by itself. Made of the sea, that the house made the most of a seaward view, almost like a person would be looking around the houses.
Yeah.
And you also sense a story is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. One evening in June, the single passing.
Yeah. It sounds like the first line.
Mm-hmm.
I like the phrase, the tree nailed, that the houses were tree nailed in among the ledges by the land.
Yeah.
Or a part of, so much a part of the surroundings that they don't need to really be.
Put a nail in the tree, sometimes it dies.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
true. Yeah, that is true. So if this were a pamphlet in, you know, the AAA office, right, you would be more likely to, you'd be more enticed to visit. Yeah. Yeah, Janet.
Given that the home really is the domestic sphere, she lifts that up as being knowledgeable, which wouldn't be typical.
Right. Not typical at all. And in fact, this whole series of sketches, it's really a beautiful book. I would highly encourage you to read it. So it's this coastal town in Maine that has pretty well died out. I mean, the other thing about regionalism is that it's quite nostalgic. I mean, this is the height of industrialization, too. And there are so many things coming together to sort of historically to make this genre happen. It's the height of industrialization. So we have Carrie talking about the trees being felled, and we have Stowe talking about, she's mourning sort of this modernization of the world, and Jewett too. And so regionalism also sort of looks back to a simpler time. And so the town in which this series of sketches takes place is this kind of dying sea town. And there are almost no male characters in the town. And there are also no children, really. Yeah. Well, really. I mean, you need them. You need them. And the male characters who are there have become sort of feminized. There's a captain who sits and knits and tells stories of his seafaring days. But he and there's another character who misses his wife, who has died so much that all he can talk about to visitors who come is her. And he sort of, in some ways, has become her. I mean, he's doing very domestic kinds of things, like cooking and cleaning, and because he's the only one in the home to do those things. And then there's this interesting thing of no children.
Yeah.
So it is a town that is just sort of a lot of older women, childless women largely, and there's lots of visiting. And so they travel around. And so, but I found interesting in this opening sketch that I hadn't really noticed before today when I read it again, is that it seems like it's two different voices talking almost. Like the first paragraph, even though it never uses the first person, feels first person, doesn't it? And then it shifts into third person. That a person has arrived after having been there, right? And then after this, what you don't have is that it shifts back into a first person. So this person who has arrived on the landing becomes the narrator of the story, but it's this funny little shift of presenting that person in the third person.
And then
it's called a return because the narrator of the sketches is a person who has visited Dunnet Landing, and she's a city person, and she's a writer. And so she has been to Dunnet Landing, and then she's returned to the city and gone about her writing things, and now she's returning to Dunnet Landing to collect, observations for yet another thing that she would like to write. And what she ends up living with a character named Mrs. Todd, who's an herbalist, and she is a widow, and she has no children, and she takes this writer into her home, and she stays with her for the summer, but she's always pulling her out of her little writing den. No, stop that. Come with me. We're going to go visit my mother today. Or come with me. We're going to go visit this character. Or we're going to go visit Captain Tilly. And so it becomes this whole thing about visiting. And what the narrator learns, one of the things that she learns throughout the story, is that visiting is and listening is the real act of writing. That you have to listen. So it's this really beautiful image of what it means to be a writer.
Were some of the men gone to hunt, for the West, or?
Well, certainly that was happening in real life.
Yeah, so we reflect by there, some of them left it up, and then are in town.
And of course, post-Civil War, too, it was really a largely feminine society after that war. Like it is after any war, really. Other things about Jewett or observations you're making among the three writers? Or? So as you think about this list of the guide, the characteristics of the perfect guide, Are these narrators hitting the mark? I know it's difficult to tell when you're just reading how they're introducing you to their region.
Well, my sense is they're giving the insider local view. Mm-hmm. They all speak as participants in the places they're speaking.
So then, was Alice Carey from a farm background? Mm-hmm. So she really was an insider.
She really was, but she lived on the outskirts of Cincinnati. Right, which was the last day. Right. Other things. Do you feel, how about this notion of discovery and being connected and passionate and telling stories? Some, how many of you thought of, that those things were important?
I think that in Jewett, I get right into the story.
Yeah.
So it seems like a good storyteller.
Yeah,
who is this person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I read it today, I was thinking of this place. You know, about the children following her, and I was thinking of the clapping when the bus arrives. You know, it's sort of everybody turns out to see who is the visitor, right? Who is the newbie? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and the childish center of civilization, or certainly, that certainly applies to Holden.
Yeah.
If Holden could run the world.
Yeah. No, or at least she doesn't.
She was later. Yeah.
But, and part of that is that she was later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the writers at that time leaving children out. Is this the beginning of when children were not treated like little adults, but just kind of ignored?
Yeah, I mean, prior to that, they were treated like little adults. And now this is, I don't know a whole lot about that time period. I think what I would say is that it's true that children did not figure into women's literature much now in this time period. Now, previously, when you're writing in the sentimental era, it's all about, you know, getting married and having children, and that's what it's for. This era does this interesting leap forward to look at women more my age, you know, middle-aged women who have raised their children,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of interior life do they have now? And can we talk about women beyond talking about them as mothers and wives? And so these women are making that move, and part of that is to say that women have a subjectivity beyond being mothers, and in order to give them a voice and a subjectivity, it seems as though these writers felt that they had to take them out of, you know, pluck them out of those roles and eliminate those roles for them so that they could say something.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of that apology that comes through, so that sense of that, do you know how much of that is geography and how much of that is gender?
I think it's mostly gender. I do. Although I think it also has something to do with class. I think for Stowe, she was very aware of herself as a middle class woman, and a middle class woman was not to speak. If she had been a working class woman, she could have blabbered on forever, and that would have been perfectly acceptable. But as a middle class woman, who was a clergyman's daughter and a clergyman's wife, she wasn't really supposed to open her mouth too much.
As an upper class person, could you have a voice?
That's what she would be. But maybe more than middle class. I mean, middle class was kind of, I mean, it was a new class at that time. It was kind of, and it was a growing class, and most people were trying to figure out who they were and what it meant and what the expectations were socially for them to be what they were. And I think it also has to do with that sense of artistry that you mentioned earlier, Paul, that women, when Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, part of the reason that she could get away with it, as I mentioned, mention was that she was taking on the role, a maternal role of teacher, and even sermonizing a little bit, and that was okay. And other women writing at that time could get away with it because they would explain in their prefaces that they had to do this to sort of put food on their table. Because either they had no husband any longer, or their husband was out of work or something, and so it was a way to feed their, care for their children was to write this novel to make money so that they could care for their children. But Jewett and Carey, and probably Stowe by this time, are really, their purpose is they want to be a writer. And they want to be considered an author. And that's dangerous ground to be walking on at that time.
Because in terms of the guide parallels,
yeah,
there are overtones here that remind me of traveling to the third world.
Yeah.
Or being a first world person, you do get that sense of apology. I hope this will be okay for you.
Mm-hmm.
People know it's not what we're accustomed to in the way of food and water and bathing. And,
mm-hmm.
and so, I mean, the class comment is very helpful because that's more class that's operative there than geography,
yeah,
too, really.
And do we have a term for that now, like slum tourism or something? Slum tourism,
yeah,
or ghetto tourism, that we worry about going into those third world places and having it just be an experience where we are coming at it with an outsider's gaze and passing judgment upon what we're seeing, as opposed to really getting in and hanging out with the people and the locals. And I think that's what these women are trying to do, right? But be careful, right? I mean, naturalism is happening at this time too, and that was sort of slum tourism, taking us into the pubs and the ghettos and the, you know, showing us the other side of life. And it was a way, part of the objective of that was to make the reader feel better about him or herself, but at least I'm not that guy, you know.
Did people figure this out, that this was Harriet Beecher Stowe at that time, when she used this pen name of Horace Folio?
Yeah, I don't think it was really anybody's secret.
No.
But
it was just a disguise. It was like, you know, going to masquerade party almost, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah,
it was just, you know, people kind of knew who everybody was.
Yeah.
They still use this as a cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It seems to give her some more sense. You know, even though everybody,
maybe must have given her the freedom that she wanted in writing that, or a new voice at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe it helped her step into a different narrative voice then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else,
yeah? Were the women being criticized for writing, period, or because of what they were writing about? I mean, were the men criticizing them out loud in periodicals like letters to the editor and stuff like that?
Yes.
So I know they do that to the women, the recent women, and they did it to the women in the 1920s.
Yes.
So I just wonder what form it was taking, because they're very sensitive.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they would be lambasted by reviews, you know, I mean, book reviews were happening then too, and it was often very much an attack on not so much their writing, but on their womanhood.
The fact,
it was improper to be writing.
Yeah.
It's after 7:15, and so I know in interest of time, I'm happy to stay and continue the conversation with anybody who would like to, but if you can't, you have places to be.
Thank you.